The year is 1242. Konrad von Hochstaden is a prisoner in a room at Nideggen Castle. How had he ended up in this unfortunate situation? He, the great Archbishop of Cologne, in captivity, captured by the Count of Jülich, who was actually his subject. His imprisonment was certainly a low point for Konrad von Hochstaden, and yet he was to go down in history as one of the most powerful archbishops of the Middle Ages in Cologne, a powerful city ruler of Cologne who knew how to enforce his rule but also relinquished it in other places. An ally of the people of Cologne and even their enemy. So much of an enemy that it would take two major efforts to reconcile the citizens and the archbishop. I too am reluctant to go along the lines of the medieval bishops, but firstly they were the rulers of the city in the High Middle Ages and therefore provide a great historical source. Secondly, yes, Konrad von Hochstaden would be one of the most powerful Cologne city lords in the city's history, ranking in the same league as Anno or Bruno. But he would be one of the last in the form of an archbishop. Which also speaks in favor of taking a look at Konrad. He would rule for almost a quarter of a century, and all the things that would happen in that time, the laying of the foundation stone of Cologne Cathedral, the today's Cologne Cathedral, the interregnum, Albertus Magnus, the small verdict and the big verdict. None of this means anything to you, or at least parts of it don't. Never mind, we'll discover all that in the coming episodes. But as I said, here in 1242, Konrad was sitting in his room at Nideggen Castle, and he didn't feel not so good. Would he ever get out of here again? He had heard that the Hohenstaufen and King Konrad IV would love to get his hands on him. Should the Count of Jülich really do this and hand him over to his political opponent, the king, Konrad would be in deep in big trouble. How did Konrad get into this predicament at all? You'll find out right after the intro. And with that, welcome back to the History of Cologne, a podcast about the history of the city of Cologne that is over 2,000 years old, but until it became what is today, this old city on the Rhine has endured a colorful and rich past, hence it can therefore be seen as a microcosm of European history. In this podcast you can listen as the city grows from the Romans up until our present time. In this episode we look at the first years of Konrad's reign over Cologne. What was the political situation in the Rhineland? How was it in the Empire? And of course, for us as fans of Cologne city history, what was the relationship like with the citizens in the early years? That's what we will be looking at this time, and believe me, an old Cologne virtue comes to the fore again here, meaning being flexible when it comes to loyalty. And that applies not only to the citizens of Cologne, but also to the city ruler himself. Let's start from the beginning. Konrad von Hochstaden, probably born around the year 1200 into the von Hochstaden-Aare family, was a Rhenish noble family from what is now the district of Euskirchen on the Lower Erft River, about 50 kilometers south of Cologne. The von Hochstaden-Aare family had blood ties with the ruling Hohenstaufen dynasty. Despite being born into a noble family, the problem for Konrad was that he had an older brother, as he will inherit the older brother. Everything from his father, Konrad embarks on a clerical career in which he can strive for political and spiritual power as a priest. He is completing his studies in Cologne and probably also in Paris. The latter is the place where clergymen would want to go to study at that time. Did Konrad perhaps sit near Archbishop Engelbert during his studies in Cologne? Had he perhaps been sitting within earshot when he came up with the idea of building a new, larger Cologne cathedral? That had certainly been in Engelbert's interest, only his assassination in 1225 prevented further implementation. Be that as it may, Konrad rapidly climbed the church career ladder, without being ordained as a priest. We all know that, and like so many before him, he was only ordained a priest later after being elected a bishop. As a nobleman, he kept all his options open. Could it be that you wanted to marry after all, or that an inheritance fluttered in somewhere? Best not be ordained a priest until then. In 1226, we know that he was a canon of Cologne Cathedral at the age of around 26. In other words, a member of the cathedral monastery. The monastery church of St. Maria at Grados was located directly adjacent to the east of the cathedral until the 19th century, and there he was given the lucrative office of provost, which gave him power, prestige, and of course income as administrator of all the scattered and numerous properties and lands of the monastery. But Konrad wants more, of course. Accumulating offices is not unusual at this time. Konrad cleverly exploited a dispute in the cathedral chapter, so among the members of the cathedral monastery. He has himself elected provost also of the cathedral itself by some of its members. This meant he had finally hit the jackpot. As head of the cathedral monastery, he would be one of the most powerful players in the Cologne church, with great spiritual as well as secular power. But there is a problem. Small problem. When Konrad is elected provost of the cathedral in 1234, there is already someone in the office, and he is alive and very well. Another fun fact, his name is also Konrad, Konrad von Büren. The two are now vehemently squabbling over the office, the two Konrads, and if you think that, as clergymen, they are dueling in great debates, you are mistaken. After all, they are noblemen who know how to use violence as a political tool. They quarrel and fight all over town, and probably not just in the city, but in the old Cologne Cathedral building itself. You have to imagine that. It must have caused such a stir that the Pope in faraway Rome noticed that. He tried to put a stop to the whole thing from afar in the Eternal City. Pope Gregory IX excommunicated Konrad for this in 1237, trying to seize the office of provost in the Cologne Cathedral. But now it shows that speaking the law and enforcing the law are two sides of the same coin, because Konrad von Hochstaden is totally unimpressed by that. And not just him, because when Henry of Millenach died the following year on March 26th, 1238, it was only around a month before a new archbishop was elected on April 30th. Even at this point, we still do not know the exact composition of the electoral body within the Cologne Church that chose the archbishop, but we do know that this is the very last time. It should remain unclear, because later, the next time, in 1261, the Cologne Cathedral chapter would take over the election of the bishop and exclude the other senior clergy in the Cologne Archbishopric from this election, or not even allow them to take part in it at all. Of course, exceptions prove the rules. We have already covered this in previous episodes, and I hope this is a metaphor that also applies into English, that exceptions prove the rules. I doubt it, but let's carry on. But well, we do not know who elected the archbishop, but we do know who was elected, namely Konrad von Hochstaden, the excommunicated, controversial provost of Cologne Cathedral and St. Maria at Grados. Not really possible, you would say, but Konrad von Hochstaden probably had enough allies and power in Cologne that this minor fault, I mean, not really, it was not a minor fault, it was a major fault of being excommunicated from the church you now serve as a bishop, well, that was not decisive in the election. And what about the emperor? He didn't care about Konrad's excommunication either. Frederick II was related to the new Archbishop of Cologne, to Konrad, and the well-known line of conflict, who had the say in matters of canon law or secular matters in Italy and in the empire, Pope or Emperor, was still going on, and Frederick II, still fighting against the Pope, therefore handed Konrad the rights to rule without a second thought. So he didn't care about his excommunication either. And yet the excommunication was a nuisance for Konrad. That's he wanted to clear. So Conrad traveled to Rome in 1239 to meet Pope Gregory IX, who had excommunicated him in the first place. And lo and behold, Conrad was successful. He returned to Cologne as an excommunicated person, so to speak. What price did he have to pay for this to the Pope? We get to that in just a moment. But a hint, the Pope also paid a lot for it. I mean, literally. He paid off the huge mountain of debt that Conrad's predecessor, Henry, had left behind for the Cologne Church. So now that Conrad von Hochstaden returned to Cologne in the summer of 1239, just in time to escape the annual malaria epidemic in the Eternal City, we should take a look at the political situation in the Rhineland and then also at Cologne itself and how he related to the people of Cologne. All of this is important, of course, in order to understand further historical developments of the city right after a short break and I have to drink something. It's a really hot day. Do you remember how Ingelbert of Berg, or von Berg better said, found himself fighting against surrounding princes in the Rhineland? It may seem strange to us that a bishop acted like a territorial prince so that there was no separation of state and church. It is even the other way around, that state and church should be separate, which was not even possible in the world of thought back then. Even an emperor saw himself as a spiritual actor and ruler, as a defender of Christianity. Why else were there so many areas of conflict between emperor and pope non-stop at that time? This inseparable unity of secular and spiritual elements characterized all areas of daily life. Aeneid is often also thought too briefly as someone who merely appears as a warrior who possesses a horse, armor, and a sword. But this negates almost half of what made Aeneid complete, the religious aspect. In our secularized and almost religion-free era, this is sometimes difficult to understand for us people nowadays. The Archbishop of Cologne is therefore not just a bishop who holds services and administers and presides over church structure, he is also a powerful imperial prince and takes part in political power games, just like a secular duke or count. That was even expected from him, that was not something abnormal. And sometimes the archbishop even was much more than that. If we look at the political map around Cologne, the situation was the same as it had been in Ingelbert's time around 20 years earlier, and yes, there's a map on my homepage, the history of Cologne.com, where you can look at the map in the blog post of this episode. The territory of the Counts of Berg began directly on the right bank of the Rhine, east of Cologne, right on the riverbank in fortified Deutz, for example. We already know it from the episode that was all about this dynasty. At this time, it's virtually connected to the house of the Dukes of Limburg. The ruler at that time was Henry of Limburg, who is also well known to us. He would live until 1246 as Count of Berg and Duke of Limburg. To the north and east of the Bergish possessions lay the exclave of the Church of Cologne behind the County of Mark, the so-called Duchy of Westphalia. As is well known, this had already led to conflicts in early episodes. Also on the right bank of the Rhine was the county of Sayn, which was located to the south of the Bergish possessions. Here the Sayn dynasty looked enviously to the west, perhaps one day to claim the narrow Cologne strip along the Rhine in order to gain access to the important and strategic waterway of the empire and Europe after all. The situation was similar to the west of Cologne. The dominion of the Church of Cologne stretched like a broad band to the left of the Rhine via Bonn, Cologne, further north to Neuss and up to Rheinberg on the lower Rhine. The Duchy of Jülich lay directly adjacent to the west of Cologne. Already familiar to us from early episodes and especially from the intro to this episode. And even further west and real powerhouse back then is Brabant, a duchy that lay between the Empire and France and would become important for the region in the further history of the 13th century. Likewise, the county of Loon was also there in the area. And yeah, are you now confused by this? Me too. As I said, you can find a corresponding map on my homepage for the podcast episode on thehistoryofcologne.com in episode 75, I think we are right now. All of these players in the regional struggle in the Rhine-Meuse region pursued a policy of territorialization at the time. In other words, each ruler attempted to create coherent and cohesive dominions. Territorial dominions in which the respective count or duke or bishop had sole power. This was done internally, of course, by gradually ousting lesser nobles from positions of power and possessions, or at least tying them more closely to themselves politically, but also externally, of course. They wanted to have a contiguous territory in which they could reach every corner of the domain without having to cross the borders of another from time to time, just as the Archbishop of Cologne always had to travel through Burgish territory to reach his Duchy of Westphalia when he traveled from Cologne to Westphalia. It is like one of the many preludes to the famous Battle of Röhringen in 1288, one of the greatest night battles of the Middle Ages, right outside the gates of Cologne, where all these parties would clash. But anyway, I don't want to spoil anything. First, back to the year 1239, when Conrad von Hochstaden returns to Cologne from Rome. The surrounding political regional rivals sensed their chance to annex territories at the expense of the Cologne Church. They attack. But on what grounds, or rather a pretextual justification, because we know the real reason, expansion of power. I told you that Conrad von Hochstaden had traveled to Rome as an excommunicated man, and miraculously, although he had Staufer blood, he was able to come to an agreement with the Pope. Not only that, Conrad not only returned north of the Alps as a reinstated member of the church, the Pope also helped him to reduce the enormous mountain of debt that Conrad's predecessor, Henry of Müllenach, had left to the Church of Cologne. So what had Conrad offered the Pope to bring about such a change of heart? Nothing less than his loyalty. Conrad von Hochstaden, born into a family of blood ties to the Hohenstaufen imperial dynasty, switched to the camp of those loyal to the Pope in the Empire, and thus into the hostile camp of Emperor Frederick II and co-regent King Conrad IV. As I said, the Pope party is fighting against the Hohenstaufen party inside the Empire. And who, man, Conrad really shows here being flexible and loyalty. The surrounding rulers look at this as an opportunity to attack him. In order to defend the emperor's honor, the archbishop, his domain, and of course Cologne were to be punished, and so the conflict ran its course from 1241. Things quickly became dicey for Conrad. Not only was the archbishop of Cologne surrounded by enemies on all sides, but the city of Cologne itself refused to take sides with the city ruler and remained neutral in this conflict, in this regional feud, not on the empire level. Perhaps there were secret agreements between Conrad's opponents and the citizens of Cologne, because even when the archbishop's territory was overrun with violence, they announced that they, Conrad's enemies, would leave the city of Cologne and citizens in peace. At Lechenich, today a district of Erftstadt, around 30 kilometers southwest of Cologne, Conrad suffered that fateful defeat in February 1242. Not only did he lose the battle against the Count of Jülich, he even became his prisoner. The feudal lord was now a prisoner of his subject and was deported to the castle of Nideggen. When the king from the Hohenstaufen dynasty, who ruled the empire in absence of his imperial father who stayed in Italy, when this Conrad from Hohenstaufen learned of this, and now there are too many Conrads in this episode again, the Staufer the Hohenstaufen king traveled to the region rejoicing. He immediately demanded that Conrad be handed over to him, his enemy. But here became clear again, the regional nobility had only allowed the conflict to escalate under the pretext of defending the honor of the Hohenstaufen dynasty, so the emperor and king. Now it was more about increasing their own regional power. And so the archbishop was not handed over to the Hohenstaufen dynasty by the Count of Jülich. I was struggling if he was a count or a duke already. Because later Jülich would become a duchy. So, King Conrad IV was unable to assert himself. In order to make the best of it, he then traveled on to Cologne in the spring of 1242. The city was currently without an acting ruler, and might be possible to dust off a little something here, the Hohenstaufen king thought. In other words, King Conrad IV wanted to confiscate the treasures and income of Archbishop Conrad of Hochstaden and take them with him. But that didn't work either. It was not only the Cologne clergy who prevented them from being handed over, the riches, also the citizens of Cologne refused to hand over the archbishop's treasure to the king. The king soon realized that he had even put himself in danger with his visit to the city on the Rhine, because rumors spread in the city that there were plans among the citizens of Cologne to kidnap the king in order to use him, the king, in return for the release of the city's ruler. And we already know the Cologne family who were allegedly planning to do this from two chronological episodes earlier. The wise man of the Mühlengasse. That's an interesting twist. Unlike the other family, the other patrician families who waited, the von der Mühlengasse openly sided with the archbishop. However, the plan was not implemented, as the king was probably too well protected, or the consequences of such a move were feared. It would be another 250 years or so before a German king was captured in Cologne, but that's not a cruel story. It's a really fun story after all, but we will get to that in 250 years. As already mentioned, Conrad was, the Archbishop of Cologne, Conrad, not the King Conrad. Archbishop Conrad von Hohenstaufen was imprisoned at Nideng Castle. However, his rule in the town was not called into question. On the contrary, the clergy and inhabitants, as we saw, protected his rule in his absence. We should therefore take a look at the interesting relationships between the archbishop, so speaking of the city ruler, and the citizens of Cologne at that time, after a short break. For this, we will only look at the relationship between Conrad and the city of Cologne during the first years of his reign, not his whole 25 years. So, meaning we will only talk about the relationship up until his capture in 1242. When Conrad became the new Archbishop of Cologne on April the 30th, 1238, he faced the same challenges as all of his predecessors. As he had already held high church positions in Cologne under Engelbert von Berg and Henry von Müllenarg, he was certainly more than familiar with this development going in the city. Conrad was fundamentally unwilling to cede even more power in his residential city to the citizens. Nevertheless, like his predecessors, he pursued this balancing act, wavering back and forth between preserving the traditional archiepiscopal rule of the city on the one hand and granting more privileges to the citizens on the other, always with the big goal in mind, of course, to be a powerful imperial prince who was also having many tasks to accomplish outside of Cologne and not only in Cologne. Conrad plays the so-called long game. He's taking his time, not governing directly with a sledgehammer like his predecessor Engelbert did, and not fighting citizen uprisings too aggressively for the time being. Better to wait for a suitable time. In his early years, Conrad was also very devoted to the citizens of Cologne and their cause. On July 23rd, 1239, so shortly after his return from Rome and only being an archbishop for a year, he guaranteed all people in Cologne the so-called ius de non evocando. That's Latin and it means the right not to be summoned to appear before a foreign court. In other words, Cologne residents could no longer be dragged before a foreign court outside the city for criminal offenses they had done inside the city, because that was still possible back then. If you had previously been accused of a crime in the city as a citizen of Cologne, there was really always the risk that the archbishop would bring you before court outside the city, or the duke of Limburg, for example, would get his men to the city and drag you out in front of a court in his territory. No, that was no longer possible. The fear for many Cologne citizens back then was, especially with the archbishop, that officials who were much more in line with the archbishop would then sit in court outside of the city than, for example, a court within the city where the lay judges, the magistrates, the chefin, so to speak, were now largely made up of members of wealthy Cologne families. This meant there was a greater chance that they, the courts in Cologne itself, would be more lenient in their judgments as foreign courts that were totally under the control of foreign rulers or the archbishop. It doesn't sound like a big deal, especially for someone like me who has no knowledge about jurisprudence at all. But it was, really. It was a significant step towards an autonomous citizenship in Cologne. Every inhabitant of Cologne was now not only physically safe from external enemies within the walls, thanks to a mighty city wall made out of stone, they were now also legally safe within the city. People in Cologne could only be sentenced for crimes committed in the city by Cologne courts in the city. It was like a second but now invisible city wall that gave the people of Cologne more protection. And here too, the citizens of Cologne showed their shrewdness, because when the archbishop was imprisoned, the same promise was obtained from Emperor Frederick II and also from the Pope with regard to ecclesiastical courts. We can also see the same ambivalence in the mutual relationship among the citizens of Cologne. The desire for demarcation but also cooperation with the archbishop. They insist on more autonomy, yes, and freedoms. You find out what these are in a moment. However, the citizens did not want to completely kick out the archbishop as lord of the city. Conrad von Hochstaden is the true power on the Rhine and beyond. Naturally, the citizens want to cooperate with such a mighty archbishop in order to have secure trade routes along the Rhine. This is of paramount interest in the city's upper class, most of whom are merchants. The old, often abbreviated narrative about medieval Cologne and its history, that citizens and the archbishop fought for power in the city for centuries, is therefore not always true. Many of Cologne's citizens were in the service of the archbishop, had become rich as a result, or served him as lenders, and thus earned themselves a fortune. We see a lot of good cooperation, especially in the initial phase of Conrad of Hochstaden's rule. Even before 1242, there were armed conflicts in the region in which the players we already know in the region wanted to get their hands on Conrad. In the spring of 1239, so really in his really early days, when Conrad actually wanted to travel to Rome for the debate with the Pope that we already know about, the Duke of Limburg and also Count of Berg, already well known to us as Henry the Fourth of Limburg from a previous episode, pressed against the Archbishop. You already know from the episode about the Lords of Berg that Deutz, which lies directly on the other side of the river from Cologne, was a Berg possession. Although given as a fief by the Cologne Church, it was de facto under the control of the Count of Berg. In this conflict, the citizens of Cologne and the Archbishop together made a quick process on the Bergish bastion right on the doorstep on the Rhine. In the spring of 1239, Cologne merchants built siege towers on two of their ships, sailed the short distance on the other side of the river, and stormed the large watchtowers that were supposed to protect Deutz and its monastery. Deutz, the settlement itself, was largely spared, however the people of Cologne tore down the towers. Of course, the Cologne merchants did not do this out of pure charity, because on March 17th, 1239, so shortly after, the city lord, Konrad, announced to the citizens of Cologne that he would waive the so-called beer penny, a tax that had to be paid on beer in the city, like a kind of alcohol tax. Later, he also waived the tax on wine, a lucrative source of income that the archbishop gave up here. He then even allowed the city to levy and collect the beer penny itself, and later, in return for this privilege, however, the archbishop received a certain share of the revenue. But of course, there were also conflicts between the city and its ruler. What a wonder! Cologne, which had often always been anti-Hohenstaufen, was not so enthusiastic about the quick, sudden change of side of the city ruler from 1240 onwards. On the contrary, the citizens of Cologne spoke out in favor of the Hohenstaufen side. Interestingly, however, this did not cause any great stress between the city and Konrad von Hochstaaten. They, both sides, agreed to let the matter go in exchange for a certain payment from the citizens to the archbishop, and quite interestingly, both sides admitted that they were now going their separate ways in terms of imperial foreign policy. The city did its thing, the archbishop his thing, supporting the pope's side, and the city supporting the Hohenstaufen side. Konrad also made clear, should he get involved in military conflicts outside of Cologne, he would no longer be allowed to call Cologne citizens to arms as he had done before, unless of course the individual citizen expressly wanted to do so voluntarily, just like the family of the wise man from the Mühlengasse. Those are really important steps to a more autonomous citizenry of Cologne. Now they don't even have to pick up the arms when their liege lord calls for it. That's a great thing back then. So, all this was the period from 1238 to 1242, the first 4 years in which Konrad von Hochstaaten had a thoroughly mixed start. For here in the summer of 1242, he is a prisoner in Nideggen Castle. But Konrad von Hochstaaten would not have gone down in history as one of the most powerful archbishops of Cologne if his journey had already ended here. Konrad von Hochstaaten was actually in a hopeless situation in 1242. He was the prisoner of a subject, the Count of Jülich. The emperor and his co-regent from the Hohenstaufen dynasty, King Konrad IV. But then Konrad, the Hochstaaten Konrad, achieved a true masterpiece of negotiation. One of the most important things he managed to do was not to be handed over to the Hohenstaufen dynasty, for Konrad also knew that he had much more to offer his regional adversaries than the Hohenstaufen dynasty, who had their main focus mainly in Italy anyway. A few political concessions. The promise not to take revenge on the Count of Jülich and his allies, and a payment of 4,000 marks of silver made Konrad von Hochstaaten a free man again after 9 months in November of 1242. Why did Konrad von Hochstaaten had such a good position in negotiation? Well, his church apparatus, his city, and also the landed gentry in the archbishopric had, as we already learned, stood by him, or at least not spoken out against him as his enemies had perhaps initially hoped. This had also strengthened his negotiation position. The next success for him was that he made peace with the ruler of Limburg and Burg, who was in a personal union, being Henry of Limburg. Beck continued to receive Deutz as an archiepiscopal fief, as before, with the clause that the towers and walls surrounding Deutz would have to be totally demolished. As a concession to Konrad, but of course also to Cologne, the city of Cologne itself, which did not want to have a fortress directly opposite on the other side of the river, which could endanger free trade and shipping on the Rhine. The citizens of Cologne were prepared to pay a large amount of money for this, which was raised in every ward of the city under the supervision of the still young city council, which acted as the supreme body of the wards. From 1243 at the latest, all battles between Conrad and the Rhenish nobles of the region were over for the time being, and peace was concluded, and this gave Conrad time to consolidate his territory internally now. Well, that's all for this time. You might have guessed, it was a bit difficult to get back into the rhythm after the summer break. It's totally hot here in Cologne, Germany right now. My tongue is dry, and I hope I've introduced Conrad von Hochstaden. I always want to say Hohenstaufen, which is totally wrong. Conrad of Hochstaden, appropriately in the course of the storyline here. Of course, we'll be seeing him here for a while yet, because, as I said, he will rule for nearly 25 years. What will the next episode be about? The laying of the foundation stone of today's Cologne Cathedral in 1248? Albertus Magnus, the great scholar of his time? Or something completely different? I don't know yet at this point. A lot of things are taking place at the same time now, and deciding what should come first is quite a challenge. Let me surprise you in 3 weeks. Many thanks to Tobias and Michael as new patrons who are supporting the podcast now in the long term. Thank you very much. I'm also grateful to the PayPal donations. Thanks to Ingeborg, Hajo, Norbert, Antje, Christian, Rolf, Thorsten, Martina, Brigitte and Sylvia. And as literature, I used the Rhenish History Portal by the L4R, which I cannot really translate to English. It's a supra-communal institution who takes care of social works and cultural stuff in the region. And of course, a book about the history of the Archdiocese of Cologne by Joachim Oepen was also taking part in it, in German, of course, Das Erzbistum Köln by Joachim Oepen, and of course, Hugo Stehkamp and Dietmar, Karl Dietmar, with their book Cologne in the High Middle Ages, or in German, Köln im Hochmittelalter. Yeah, that's it for this episode. As I said, it's a bit difficult to get back into rhythm. I am too hot right now. Let's end this episode for now. Recommend me further. Please forgive my mistakes. And see you next time. Auf Wiedersehen.